Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer, and in a sudden turn of events, Islamic rebel group Al-Shabaab has left the Somali capital of Mogadishu last week, creating an opening for international relief organizations to more easily get supplies to Somali stricken by the worst famine on earth in 20 years. On Monday, President Obama approved an additional $105 million in aid to East Africa, and Jill Biden, the wife of Vice President Joe Biden, returned yesterday from a visit to refugee camps in Kenya, where thousands of Somalis arrive every day. The death toll from the drought in the Horn of Africa is in the tens of thousands, and more than a half million children are at risk of starvation. Despite the retreat of the al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Shabaab out of Mogadishu, the group still controls the southern and central parts of the country. Here to discuss Somalia in light of the Horn of Africa crisis is Jay Bahadur. He is the author of the newly released The Pirates of Somalia, Inside Their Hidden World. Jay Bahadur, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
Well, we have so much to discuss, as we always do when we talk about Somalia, but I think the obvious place to begin today is with the retreat of al-Shabaab out of the Somali capital, Mogadishu. They characterized the withdrawal as tactical. They had been losing battles to the African Union's peacekeeping force in Mogadishu, but the group still controls most of central and southern Somalia, and the Somali government remains weak. What's your assessment for the retreat?
Well, I think it's certainly a product of weakness. Shabaab has been losing ground for a number of months now. The federal government in Mogadishu has made several key advancements. And more than that, the local people have really turned against them, and the famine has contributed to that, because Shabaab, for ideological reasons, is denying there's a famine and is forcefully stopping people from leaving territory controls, carrying out really brutal medieval punishments that are repugnant to most Somalis. And so I think this is the retreat out of Mogadishu is certainly not a chosen tactic, put it that way. And I think that very much, like I said, very much it's a product of weakness. And One thing that's important to make clear, though, is that Shabaab has pulled out of its bases, but they're still certainly have a presence there in terms of militants on the ground who might not be immediately recognizable. So I think one possibility of all this is that, as with most insurgencies and rebel groups and so on, when they start losing ground, a lot of the time they turn to more brutal tactics. And I think it's totally possible that Shabaab may turn now to more suicide bombings like you saw in the past when they were up and coming. So I think that's potentially a very unfortunate future possibility.
And the government also faces challenges from independent gangs and criminals, other challenges as well, right?
Yeah, the government, I mean, it's barely deserves that name. It controls about, I think, six neighborhoods in Mogadishu, now more because of the Shabaab withdrawal. But it's essentially, you know, like the mayor of the president of Afghanistan is the mayor of Kabul, they say, and it's sort of similar with in Somalia. Only this government, this collection of former warlords, can't even agree on a draft constitution. I mean, this is how comical it is that for its entire mandate, they've had to work on a draft constitution and haven't been able to finish that since 2004, essentially. And really, this is not what Somalia's problems are not the lack of a constitution. They have much more fundamental problems that the government is not dealing with.
And let's talk about some of that, the other piece of this. It may be too early to tell, but do you know if aid groups and the United Nations are now, in fact, more able to get supplies into the country in light of this retreat?
Well, I think they already had a presence in Mogadishu distributing aid. I think what this might mean is that the roads to the access to Mogadishu from a population fleeing elsewhere would be more open, and certainly getting to Mogadishu to find relief would be easier, definitely. But like I said, there's no by no means is Shabaab completely out of the area, and they still retain you know the ability to strike, and But it's certainly an encouraging sign, yeah.
Now, we've been talking about Mogadishu and the central and southern parts of Somalia, but you spent most of your time in the northern parts of the country when reporting for your book, The Pirates of Somalia. And you write that the semi-functioning government in the north actually allowed piracy to flourish. Isn't that counterintuitive? How does more stability facilitate piracy?
Well, pirates run businesses, essentially, and just with any business, you want a secure and predictable environment in which to function. But at the same time, you don't want, especially in the case of illicit businesses, you don't want the police knocking at your door. So in the north, it was not only was it geographically ideal because it straddles the Gulf of Aden and Indian Ocean and was really on one of the biggest shipping lanes in the world, but it did have, and still does have, a government that functions on a budget of about $20 million a year, maintains a standing army, a militia, and it can ensure a degree of law and order that's degrees above what you see in the south. So in the south, the pirates essentially would face tons of people trying to rip them off, Islamists, warlords, even the transitional government. And in the north, they had the ability to operate in the perfect environment of not too much meddling in their affairs because the government simply didn't have the ability. But like I said, they had that stable business environment in which to function.
And before we move too far away from al-Shabaab, the pirates in the north are very careful, aren't they, to distance themselves from al-Shabaab, the southern Islamist group that we've been talking about?
Yeah, there's a lot of links or alleged links early on about pirates giving money to Shabaab and having sympathies to the insurgency and so on. But really, the pirates just want money. And one person whom I've interviewed for the book put it very well that if I'm a pirate and I'm giving money to Islamists and the American government finds out, I'm pretty sure someone's going to come and drop a bomb in my head. And that's very much more reality these days now that the U.S. has started a drone program in Somalia. And so it just didn't make sense. And Shabaab didn't control areas. Like, the pirates operate out of the north and in some areas of northern central Somalia. And Shabaab simply didn't have forces on the ground there. Why would you pay off anyone if they weren't physically threatening you, really? Especially since, like I said, these pirates don't have any ideological motivations, put it that way, besides a desire for a Land Cruiser, if you want to call that a ideology.
I'm Jamie Floyd. My guest is Jay Bahadur. He's a journalist and the author of The Pirates of Somalia, Inside Their Hidden World. You write that the growth in piracy came in part from disputes between local artisanal fishermen and commercial fishermen, but then you go on to explain that it's really not just that simple. Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, sure. I mean, I embedded in Somalia for 3 months, and one of the main gang that I interviewed and spent a lot of time with was at their houses and so on. They were originally fishermen, and that was great for me because in the book it was a lot easier to humanize them because they had this original justification of really being victimized by thuggish foreign fishing in terms of being shot at. Foreign fishing would come and run over their gear, destroy the local fisheries and deplete the lobster population, which was the main export was rock lobster. So you had that justification that really made them a lot more sympathetic than the gangsters essentially who are out there now. Their case was very much in the minority. You did have these fishermen who started out in the 90s attacking fishing ships, but the current business model you see, which is the kidnapping at sea,
which we hear so much about here in the West.
Essentially, it's a crew. They discovered circa 2005 that it was the crew that was important, not what fish on board or other things. And what they ended up doing was not conceptually different than taking the Taliban, kidnapping someone and taking them to a cave in Afghanistan, or the FARC in Colombia, taking someone into the jungle. It was conceptually the same. And the man who invented that, if you want to call it an invention, or discovered this and realized that shipping companies would pay and really created modern piracy, he was not a fisherman. But as soon as all these early fishermen pirates learned that this was working, they immediately shifted and, you know, would tell me things like, oh, yeah, commercial ships, this is commercial shipping vessels, have the same owners as the illegal fishing ships, so it's all good. And they really started taking this original justification and warping it into something completely absurd.
And you write that 20 to 30% of attempted hijackings are successful. But does that mean that ransoms are in fact paid?
You mean if there's a successful hijacking?
If there's a successful kidnapping.
Right. Well, it's been virtually... virtually 100% of the time, ransoms are paid. Now you see increasing, because the amounts are getting so high now, you had a recent ransom earlier this year that was $13.5 million, whereas when I was there, average ransoms were probably about $1.5 million to $2 million.
Where do the profits go?
The profits from the ransom?
Yes.
Well, immediately you have the first attacker, the member of the crew who jumps on the ship first, he always gets a bonus. So this could be as much as a $100,000 bonus, plus pretty much universally he'll get a Land Cruiser. So it's actually quite standard performance-linked incentive among pirates to give a Land Cruiser to the first one who boards the ship, because it's kind of a crazy thing they're doing. So they need a sort of carrying out a high-speed chase on the water, and they need an incentive. So the attacking team as a whole will get about 30%, but the real winners are the investors. There's about 30 key investors, all local, but probably holding foreign passports and moving in and out of the country, businessmen, who will generally take about almost 50% of the ransom. They front all the costs and really in the shadow of anonymity make the lion's share of the money. And then at the other end, you have the guards who are brought on and the cook just to guard the vessel when it's being held. And when I did an in-depth study that I kind of do a free economics style study in the book, and it reveals that really these guards made about $10 an hour and for spending, you know, hours and hours of tedious time on a ship.
And risking their lives, as did you. And I want our listeners to understand you were 24 years old then. You're 27 years old now. I commend the book to our listeners, The Pirates of Somalia. The author is Jay Bahadur. Thank you so much, Jay, for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
His new book, The Pirates of Somalia, Inside Their Hidden World. I'm Jamie Floyd, and for Brian Lehrer. Coming up next hour, the turmoil in London. Stay with us.